Okay, so I'll just stop. So this week is going to be a busy week. So we have a focus week this week, which I'm gonna. So the first part of my talk is just going to be to introduce very briefly what the focus week is going to be, and then I want to give a somewhat broad brush description of some issues of criticality and instabilities in Halabi that I hope are going to sort of lay the foundation for some of the rest of the talks this week. So the starting point, this focus week is going to be on strange metals and instabilities of strange metals. And so the starting point is these, not one or two, but five phase diagrams in pretty different, my present energy theory materials. So they're fluquates, nictites, organics, ruthenates, and heavy fermions. And some of them are two-dimensional, some of them are three-dimensional. And here's a phase. So all of these plots, I think I stole the concept of this page from a review that Spear wrote, where he has more or less the same pictures on them. So all these phase diagrams have temperature on this axis, and then some control parameter going along this way that might be a doping, it might be a magnetic field, or it might be a pressure. Okay. And what all of these plots show is the resistivity, so the electrical resistivity, matched to a power of T alpha, and then these plots show alpha, so the local, so something like the logarithmic derivative of the function in the T direction. Okay. And all of these plots, this axis on the side goes from 1 to 2, and in the middle, it goes like 1, and far away, it goes like 2. There are obviously differences between these materials, but that's the broad brush picture. And furthermore, in many of these materials, directly underneath the region where there's this sort of bad or strange metal behavior, there's an ordered phase. So actually, here it's been suppressed with the magnetic field, but there are superconducting phases, or in this case, there is an enigmatic phase there. I should say these talks are taken. So this came from a paper that Catherine was on, and this is from Andy's paper. So we have all the relevant people here. Okay, and then so that's ingredient number two is that there's this ordered region here. And another ingredient that shows up in many of them is the existence of another ordered phase, say a spin density wave, maybe a nematic in the cuprates that comes down and ends also in the middle of this dome. So there's some other phase boundary or some kind of boundary that's coming down and also hitting this dome on the top. So, right. Let's take those pictures. So it seems to me, again, maybe naively, that this is a theorist's dream come true. I mean, it's something exotic, but it's not just one exotic thing. It's five different exotic things that have many features in common in different materials. And they're recurring themes, three of them which I just mentioned. So a non-sort of a bad metal. So the resistivity, T, is bigger than T squared. Okay, so the conduction is less efficient here. So there's this strange metal sandwich between two fermi liquids. That's one recurring theme. There's a proximity of another phase, as seen by these kind of lines that want to come in and end. And it looks like this line wants to end in some critical point, and this critical point tends to get eaten out by some other ordered phase. And furthermore, if you look here, you often find that they're not sharply defined Landau quasiparticles. Right. So despite this wonderful bounty of interesting measurements, it seems to have been difficult to get a really solid theoretical handle on these kind of materials. So this week, what the plan is, is that we're going to discuss these kind of phase diagrams from three different perspectives. So we're fortunate enough to have two top-notch experimentalists who have come just for this week to give us a talk. So that's Andy and Ashutosh Bhalti. Gil is here yet, but hopefully he will show up. And then we also have two people that are going to, we have Steve Gilson and Seth Gil who's coming tomorrow, who will give us an overview or their perspective from the kinetic matter theory point of view. And then we're going to have a couple of talks and a discussion on Friday about holographic perspectives on these kind of things. And so hopefully these three threads will be wound together and some interesting things will come out. We also have a talk on Friday by Johanna Erdmanger on a slightly different topic, but hopefully also related. Okay, so what I want to do in this talk is as a sort of prelude to the main courses, which are coming later. I want to just introduce how various of the physical ingredients that we might use for discussing these kind of phase diagrams appear holographically. So much of this is somewhat old, but I want to cherry pick some things that might be interesting for this week. Okay, so to be a bad metal, something has to get in the way of the electrons, okay? Because you know, electrons, you find an electric field, they just want to travel, right? And if they are more obstructed here than they are here, okay? So in particular, the current has to be dissipated more efficiently than in a Fermi liquid coupled to a lattice, which is what gives you this G squared. Okay. The lattice is important, by the way, because you need to lose your momentum. Okay. You have a translation invariant system, the DC conductivity will always be infinite. Okay, but Fermi liquid plus lattice gives you T squared, so if the conductivity is worse, presumably, I guess I've already started making assumptions, but presumably this means that there's something else going on at low energies that the electrons bounce off, okay, and it prevents them from conducting as efficiently as they would in a Fermi liquid. Now, and because our UV is just electrons, okay, we don't have a Higgs boson or something, maybe they're phonons, but let's pretend they're no phonons. So if we only have electrons, these extra excitations that the electrons can bump into at low energies have to be some collective modes of the electrons that you started with in the UV. Now, so how do we get these collective modes? So, okay, I should say, so the transport of electrons, at least at weak coupling, you have this picture of a Fermi surface, and the low energy excitations are just electrons jumping out of the Fermi surface. If something else, if that's all you have, then you're going to get your T squared. So if you want these to bump into something else, there has to be some other gapless low energy degree of excitation lying around. And so condensed matter systems can do this, but they don't want to. You have to push them. So you either have to, because if it has some scalar field, it's going to be massless. The mass is a relevant operator, and it's going to get turned on. And so I need to do something to make it massless. So you can either tune your mass to zero. That's something you can't do in particle physics. But you know, we have all these knobs here, and so indeed that is what looks like might be happening on these phase diagrams. Or if you're lucky, there's some kind of kinematical constraint on the system. This a typical example would be in these smart insulating systems where there's a strong on-site repulsion and two electrons can't live on the same site, so you have some constraints. There's only one or zero electrons on a given site. That's a no double occupancy constraint. And these sort of things can lead to emergent Gauss laws and emergent gauge fields, which are then also protected gapless excitations at low energy. Okay, so the framework I'm going to talk about that I think the way holography engages with these systems is that it has these two ingredients. It has charge carriers and it has these gapless modes. Now, because we're not starting from a lattice, in holography, these critical modes are not something that you have to work to get. They're an intrinsic part of the framework. You put them in. So in particular, the theory you start with in holography very schematically looks something a little like this. So it's a large N gauge theory. Okay, that means so it's a theory of N by N matrices. And so there's a field strength, there can be scalars, there can be fermions, and there's some interaction between them. And to make holography work, you need to tune the interactions. You need to have multiple copies of scalar fields, maybe multiple gauge groups. And you tune the interaction so that it's supersymmetric and that we can understand it well. And then in some of those cases, so for some, basically something of this form, but with specific matter content for the scalars, with particular couplings between the matter, we know that there's a gravity dual. Okay. But that's the kind. So this theory doesn't have any mass terms, and so lots of massless stuff, including gauge fields, whose masslessness is maybe a little more robust than for a scalar. Okay, so the starting point are these UV scale invariant theory with gauge symmetry and with Gapler's bosons and fermions, and in fact they tend to be conformal. So that's the starting point, and as hopefully everybody knows by now, the way ADS-CFT works is it takes this conformal invariance that's living in our field theory, and it geometrizes it by writing down this ADS metric. And from this ADS metric, the conformal group acts as a geometrical symmetry, and in particular, scalings. So if you scale x by lambda x and t by lambda t, and then you scale r, so you scale out and you move in, this metric stays the same. Okay. And this action associates, so in these coordinates, r equals 0 is the boundary, and r equals infinity is a long way in. And this scaling associates things down here with long distances and things that happen near the boundary with short distances. And a cartoon for visualizing this is you project to the boundary, and things that are near the boundary are small. Things that are a long way in project out to big stuff. Right, so in holography, the situation is reversed. If we did want to get back to a Fermi liquid, we have to work to kill all these Gapler's modes, okay, that we started with. And that's not difficult to do, so you just have to start adding mass deformations to your theory, and often those can induce confinement or Higgsing of the gauge fields. And so if you manage to do that by adding some relevant operators to this, to that action that have a scale, so you have this space-time, this ADS space, will actually end. It will come in and it will close off at some point. And there'll be some space missing. So now remember, the space down here was the infrared. It's the long distance. And so the fact that you lose some of your space is the statement that you have a mass gap. There are no degrees of freedom below a certain energy scale. Okay.
I have a question. Yes. Okay, so in this case, does the symmetry of the isometry just break down to the comparable?
Yes.
Boundary?
Yes.
There's nothing more.
Yes.
That means that you can also get Fermi liquid
from this. Exactly, that's right. So exactly, and this is what actually Sabir talked about last week, but maybe I could just—it's sort of clear. I mean, so in a sense, it's a very perverse way of getting a Fermi liquid because you throw in all this Gapler stuff and then you gap it out again. Okay, and then that's right. If you add some charge to this, you're going to get a Fermi liquid because there are no other degrees of freedom at low energies. Mm-hmm. So in this framework, you will get a Fermi liquid. Yes.
Could you go back, sorry, one slide? I just wanted to ask the question about what we already were supposed to do as well. Is the metric complete as you go out to the right hand?
Right here?
Yes.
Yes, well, it has the structure it has is a conformal boundary. So up to a conformal transformation, it's yes.
No, that's not quite my question. Is that right hand boundary infinitely far away from any
point?
Yes. Okay.
It's geodesically complete.
Yeah, geodesically complete. Okay, thank you.
The things do bounce off the boundary,
maybe. Yes, but
there are boundary conditions.
Right. So.
Goodness.
But there's nothing. The boundary is well under control geometrically.
But Jay, I think this is some Lorentzian analog I'm familiar with, which is the conformal boundary to hyperbolic space.
It's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I suppose if there is in the continuum, it's impossible to put back the lattice on it, or?
No, that's good. So I wouldn't say it's impossible. Some people have thought, Shamit and others have thought a little bit about this. You could imagine, for example, adding some irrelevant operators that had information about the lattice in it. Yes, you could definitely have a line striking.
So some of the effects you mentioned for the returns, that is definitely important.
Yes, no, I tried to, absolutely. No, that's right. And I think that's an interesting thing that hasn't been explored very much. Let me say one weird, slightly maybe funny thing, is that at this, you have to be careful, perhaps, because this scale, this is the UV, so let's think of this as the electron volt scale, where the chemical potential is the electron volt. And at this scale, we already have a quantum field theory. Okay. So what you won't be able to do is get a situation where there's a lattice. Well, what I wouldn't know how to do is to have a situation where we have a lattice with things hopping on the lattice. It's like we've already taken the continuum limit. Now, you could imagine introducing sort of a hierarchy of scales where you have the lattice at an even higher scale, and then the continuum theory, and then you flow to the IR. So, I mean, right, you'd have it, if you just naively put a lattice here, you'd have the quantum field theory in the lattice background, which...
So you would show up in terms of extensions?
Yeah, so maybe you could add effects like that, yeah, I think that would be a good thing.
I just have one really naive question about the next. Sorry. I mean, where is the gaplessness of the Fermi liquid then manifest? I mean, if you gap up all your critical
right,
modes,
right.
And you're putting this gap, you know, Fermi liquid and this gapless.
Good. So good. Yeah. No, that's right. So. Right. So what? Very good. No, this is good. This is a good question. So there's a slight exception. There are exceptions. So this picture of UV and IR is mostly correct, but sometimes you can get. And the idea is this is a box, and most modes in a box will get have a finite mass. But okay, it's a sort of curved box, and sometimes you can get massless modes sort of in the box. And so there'll be some sort of wave functions that might live there that could actually be massless in certain circumstances. And that's, for example, what happened in what Subir talked about the other week.
But then one gains nothing, right?
I don't think so. No. I mean, I think it's a sanity check, and maybe it would let you deform between Fermi liquids and non-Fermi liquids. But I mean, yeah, I don't think.
So you mentioned about the lattice, but if you just put that in, you still have this,
like,
you have a lot of
gaps,
but lattice is a background.
Right, right.
So, but can I have in the lattice emerges in the sense that spontaneous
nuclear? Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So this is, yes.
That would be different kind.
Of course. That's right. So. That's right. Another thing that is understudied is spontaneous translational symmetry breaking. Yes, ripping my crystals or whatever involved.
It is ultimately where the lattices come from. It's always.
That's right. That's right. We don't want to go all the way. Okay. So indeed, as it always came up, my perspective is that these gap things may be useful for understanding the dynamics of confinement. And so, for example, if you had a dual to QCD, you could calculate the mass of the proton or something, right? That's the sort of question you can ask. But it doesn't seem to be a way of giving you interesting new states of matter, because you just put in all the interesting stuff and you threw it out again. All right, so now let me talk about the rest of this talk about non-gapped phases. Okay. So we have the critical modes, okay, and let's assume that we didn't do something to the theory that confined them and capped them. So the other ingredient we want, so again, it's always sort of backwards from how you might have started thinking about incandescent matter. So we have the critical modes, now we need the fermions, right? We need we need to add the charge carriers. So the way we do that, so we want to now put in a charge density that's going to represent the charge carriers. And this is, in fact, also a relevant deformation of the theory. We're adding this coupling, okay, chemical potential. We're adding the inserting the charge density operator. And that will induce the flow, and that will change the IR down here. And okay, hopefully everybody knows, and it's true, that the way you put in the charge density here is to insist that there's an electric flux going out to the boundary in the bulk. This electric flux has to be sourced by something, okay? And so we have to sort of imagine integrating in Einstein's equations, which are like integrating down the RG flow, and then we have to see what Einstein's equations tell us we get in the IR, given the boundary condition that there's an electric flux, which is the charge density. Right. So one sanity check that we could do is, this is related to these comments about lattice, So one thing, so the presence of charge carriers, is a quite subtle thing when you have translation invariance. So for example, while the charge is a UV boundary condition, so you know, you put 10 million electrons into whatever your sample is, okay, that's something that you can do. It actually has consequence, you can see that UV data at the lowest energy scales. And so, because if you look at the conductivity as a function of frequency, at arbitrarily low frequencies, there's going to be a delta function that's proportional to the charge density. And that's just a statement that you're not losing translation invariance. It's applying electric field, everything's going to accelerate away. And so charge is a subtle UV and IR thing, especially when it comes to transports. Okay, because so your boundary conditions here will show up in what you might have thought were IR observables. Okay, you can do that. You can calculate the conductivity in ABCFT. I'll show you an example in a minute, and you will indeed get this. The dissipative part of the conductivity is a delta function, and the imaginary part is one over omega. So that's something that the charge density definitely has to do, and it does do in these setups. Okay, but now we've put all the ingredients in place. So now we want to think about how they sort of talk to each other. And so we could take a step back and try to get some intuition from field theory, from possibly uncontrolled computations in field theory. But this a zeroth order thing that seems to happen that I think is probably pretty robust is that, so these are the gauge bosons, or these are your massless scalar field, your critical modes, and this is some matter of which you have a finite density. Okay. And it's a pretty generic thing in the theories that people like to write down, with critical bosons and matter, that what density of matter does is that it Landau damps your boson. And what that means is that your boson, which started with some dispersion relation, in our case, it started off relativistic, but I don't think that's essential, will get Landau damped, and so it will go with a higher power k. This is like, it sort of wants to be gapped. The density wants to gap it, but it sort of isn't quite able to. And so it just changes the dispersion relation.
Isn't it also given I?
Sorry? An I?
Damped means it's got an I in front of it, doesn't it?
Things get. Okay, I don't know what. Okay, this happens. I don't know maybe I shouldn't call it. I thought this was what was normally called Landau damping, but maybe.
Well,
I mean.
It's a weird frequency, there's a line. Minus.
Oh, sorry, you're right. I'm thinking, right, so in the Euclidean space, it's a model, right? You can get it is not another thing. This is Euclidean. Right. Good. So this is something that one might have some reason to expect on grounds of any computation that anybody that a non-string theorist has ever done. And so holographically, indeed, something a bit analogous to this happens. And typically, it's found. I mean, I wouldn't say always, I don't even know if I want to say universally, but it's often found that when you ask this question, I start with something in the IR, and I write down some equations in the bulk, and what's the IR, what's the metric in the, sorry, UV, what's the IR metric? You often find that it gets a new scaling form in the infrared. Oh, I'm sorry, this should be a T. That's a T. Right, so this is the same as ADS. So ADS would be this metric when Z is 1. When Z is not 1, that just tells you that when you do this scaling, you need to scale your time differently. And so, in fact, something that looks similar to Landau damping does generically happen in these systems. One effect of adding your charge density is that it's your critical modes that started off being relativistic in the UV, that you had some mode omega like K. The geometrical symmetry down here often has omega like K. So you can solve equations and this happens. There are many, many different ways of doing this. So some cases that holographers are particularly fond of. So Z equals 1, sometimes you can indeed get an emergent relativistic symmetry in low energies. Z equals infinity is the infamous ADS2 cos R2, which I think we'll hear more about on Wednesday. And but you can also get all Z's in between. Okay. So I want to discuss them all at the same time. Did that make sense?
Dt squared.
Yes, yeah, this should be dt.
That R, is that just any dimension sphere?
Sorry?
That R, is that any dimension sphere for your ADS?
So the R.
So R is this direction.
Oh, okay.
It's just Tx.
You could be in three dimensions if you wanted.
Sorry.
Is this just the most general metric one?
Good. This is the most general metric that has a scaling symmetry. Yes. Yes.
So it's conformal only in the UV and then?
So it's good. So good. This is important. So that's sort of okay. There's, let's say, scale invariant. So there are two scale invariant regimes here. There's the UV and the IR, and in this case, they both have a scaling symmetry, which is different. But this one. It's sort of something we fabricated just to introduce our massive degrees of freedom in a controlled way. And what we're really interested in is the emergent one down here. And this one indeed has scaling and also a whole conformal symmetry, while this just has it's not a realistic scaling symmetry. So did that answer?
Yeah, it's very amazing that you...
I think it's nice, that's right. Yeah, I think it's nice.
Well, I mean, you
kind of
find it density
problems, so
it's not such
a problem.
Well,
sorry, no, what's the
main problem? For me, it's amazing if you have something conformal in the UV that you would lose a symmetry in the infrared.
Oh, no, so you put in, I'm sorry, so you put in this operator, you have an insertion, you've inserted this density, which breaks the symmetry.
Okay.
I think what's nice is that something comes back to you again in the infrared, that nobody put that in to the system.
So you took Minkowski space and you're enjoying this radial dimension.
Right.
And you're kind of hyperbolic.
But now we're breaking the hyperbolic symmetry the hyperbolite is sort of scale invariant as you go in. And now by adding this charge density, we've broken the symmetry, we've broken the scaling symmetry. And then what we're saying is that we go into the far interior, the scaling symmetry comes back again. And what that's the reason that's happening, what that's fundamentally telling you, I think, is that all this massive stuff that you had, some of it survived. It didn't all get gapped out by the fact that you put the system in finite density. But, okay, let's keep going. Right. So that's one half of the equation. So you could say that the fact that you have matter sort of back reacted on your critical sector. But I guess if we want to think about resistivities and so on, what we really want to know is how these critical modes affect the conduction, the matter, right? The charge carriers. Also, sorry, so that's just what I just said now. So from this metric, which has a scaling symmetry in the infrared, you can use a dimensional analysis appropriately adapted to that symmetry. And that will tell you, for example, that the entropy density has to scale like t to the 2 over z. In 2 plus 1 dimension. That's just, you say that there are no scales in the infrared, except if you heated it up. I haven't told you how to heat it up, and I won't. But you can heat it up, and dimensionality says it has to go like that. In particular, this is not an exponentially small. Okay, so there are many degrees of freedom still at low energies. OK, so now the question you want to ask is, I've got all these critical modes. How does charge conduction dissipate into those critical modes? OK, that's the question. That's one of the questions that we started off with. And the most robust universal way you can characterize that is just by calculating the conductivity, or the imaginary part of the current two-point function equals to the density two-point function. Let's say this is a function of frequency for the moment. So the way you set that up in ADS-CFT is you sit at, okay, I'm afraid that we had a nice lecture last week on ADS-CFT, and so I'm not really going to explain everything. But what you do is you sit at the boundary. You grab a photon, you throw the photon at the black hole, some of it comes back to you, so black hole horizon. Okay, the far, some of it, some of into the space. You throw your photon into the space. Some of it will come back to you, and some of it won't. Will get transmitted. Right? Mathematically, it is exactly the form of an undergraduate scattering problem in quantum mechanics. There's a potential. You have a transmission and a reflection amplitude. Okay. And the imaginary part of the Green's function is the transmission amplitude. It's the stuff that pulls through the horizon and doesn't come back. And yeah, so before I discuss what you get when you do that, let me go on a slight tangent to emphasize that I think hopefully many people would agree that the deepest and most powerful aspect of holography is this geometrization of dissipation. Okay, it's these horizons. So what is a horizon? A horizon is something that exists because GR can play with the causal structure of space-time. Okay, you can cross the horizon and can't come back. Okay, it's a very deep fact about GR. And it's that irreversibility of causality that GR does for you that corresponds to dissipation. You fall through, everybody, if you know one thing about a black hole, is you fall in and can't get out, right? That irreversibility is what allows there to be dissipative processes at a that we can get just by solving these Schrodinger-like equations in holography. Okay. So, yeah, I think geometrization of dissipation is what makes this thing tick, in my opinion.
So it seems like from the GR point of view, a sharp transition with or without that.
Yes. I think I'm going to come back to that. So I think that's interesting. And I think, so that's right. And I think that distinguishes things that when you're not in this large n limit can sometimes be crossovers or so on. And it might allow you to talk about things like fractionalization in quite a precise way, because as you say, they're going to be different, or deconfinement.
So there will be some kind of matter system which corresponds to this, which doesn't symbolize, and then some which symbolize.
Right, although this it doesn't have to be this horizon. It can be at zero temperature as well. It doesn't have to be but no, it's exactly what it gives you a sharp distinction where there might not always be a sharp distinction for the kind of physics you want to distinguish.
Can I understand in sort of more maybe condensed matter terms that somehow your charge carriers are transferring momentum to the critical modes. Yes. The critical modes are somehow coupled to a heat bath so that whatever is transferred to them doesn't come back?
So the at zero frequency, it really will, I mean, you will see this delta function. This it's not, so once momentum falls into the horizon, you can still see it. It's not, you see ripples on the horizon. It's not that it got, so you lose some things, but you don't lose everything. Like conservation laws are, so there's no external anything in this system. I don't want to say that might be too strong. Let me, momentum is conserved. Momentum doesn't go anywhere, so you do get this delta function.
Okay.
But it is true, I'll try to come back to this, that it does go somewhere else. Yeah. When things fall in the horizon, it goes into some other degrees of freedom that are not the charge carrier, that are not the current in this case. That's why you get an imaginary point. You get an imaginary jx, because indeed the excitations have gone into non-charge carrying modes.
As far as the charge carriers are concerned, the momentum is not conserved. It can decay. The momentum into some other modes.
Yeah, but it will come back eventually.
Because
I don't want to get confused about it. So, but we haven't broken translation variance, and it's a closed system. So hopefully it will. It has this delta function, yes, at zero frequency. But at finite frequency, you get pulse like this one. So you do that experiment, and there's a delta function here that my numerics doesn't show. But okay, there's a delta function here, and so this is the real part of the connectivity, which is the dissipative part of this two-point function divided by omega. At zero momentum. And, okay, so I'm trying to be very general here. And it does, obviously the details do depend on the system. But what I've taken here are three, these are three different systems that have different values of Z in the infrared. But this plot looks essentially the same for all systems that are similar to the one we're talking about.
So the different bulk solutions.
Yes. That's right.
So you took some particular.
They all look like this. So for example, Reiser Nordstrom, electronic black holes, and electron stars, they all look like this.
So Sean, just to clarify my own understanding, it seems to me that in this field, it seems to me as an outsider that over time you guys have shifted the emphasis. But it used to be that you guys worry about whether metric is a solution, some equation, you write down equation, so on and so forth, what theory it solves, right? But now you're just saying, I don't care, I just given that metric, then you can calculate the Green's function. That's the impression I'm getting from you. And then you can compare every experiment.
I mean, everything's important, but I will be trying to emphasize features that don't depend too much on the details of the solution. Because we don't really know what the bulk description is for the systems we're interested in.
Right.
So it seems, I'm just.
But it seems the game you're playing, you can't just write down some arbitrary metric once it's not the solution of anything.
Right. So the statement is not totally orthogonal to that. It is different, which is that there are many different solutions to different things that end up looking similar.
But it's very easy to get total nonsense if you just write down a
random. That's right. That's right. There are rules. That's right. You can. That's right. Sorry. Yes. No. You're right.
That's comforting.
I want to explain a few things. About why you sort of have to get then I'm going to explain why it's more likely to be in the high temperature supercomputer. But this shape is not surprising. So people might have heard me say this before. This is something I'm fond of. So out here at high frequencies, that's the UV. Okay, we're not trying to capture the UV correctly, so we don't care too much. But our UV happens to be a scale invariant theory in supersonic dimensions, where the connectivity is dimensionless, and so it has to go from constant. Okay. But that's not, at this point at least, that's not an important feature. This is all at zero temperature. Everything is saying is at zero temperature.
It's when gradients come down.
Or up or something. Yes, whichever. Yes, it does what it has to do. Yeah.
Whatever it gets.
Yes, sorry. I took three different solutions to different equations that were characterized by the fact that the scaling, the emergent scaling in the infrared, different values of Z.
So these are different Zs?
Yes. So that's like, I don't remember, 2, 3.5, something, 1, I don't know.
So when you say three different solutions, the same metric but with different values of Z?
Well, and therefore different metrics. But yes.
Yeah. It's the same metric.
Same form of the metric.
Same form.
All the way from this all the way to the.
This is the full metric, that's right.
The metric inside doesn't look.
That's right. All kind of funny stuff. Yeah. Well, not too much.
Can you predict from the.
Good. So in a specific theory, there will be a specific value of Z. Right. Yes. In principle, yes. Now, in the cases where we know for sure what the dual theory is, what the theory that lives here actually is, so, you know, n equals 4 sub n mills, something that we know. Finding the right background is a little complicated, and because there are many, many fields, and it's not easy to know what Z is. But in principle, it's there, and in sort of simplified models like the ones I'm looking at, where you don't have too many fields in the bulk, then you'll get the Z. So Z will depend on things. So I don't think it's robust. I can't tell you what Z is for a spin density wave transition coupled to a Fermi surface or something.
Well, that I can tell you that.
Well,
no, don't you get Z is already not bad. I mean,
so there is a Z. Z is something that the thing. Yeah, I think it's nice. Right, but what I was trying to say is that it doesn't seem to make sense to try to compare these Z's to experiments because the theories are totally different. I mean, microscopically, they're not. These are model theories that hopefully share some things in common with those phase diagrams, but they're like another example of it, right? That's right, maybe I should have, that's right. It's like we had those five plots, now I'm adding a sixth one that looks the same, but it's not any of those metals. It's a toy system, right?
Could you help to distinguish infinite Z or minus Z from modest
Well, not in, not in this.
Not one and Z.
Okay,
are
so.
Are those three classes something that experimentally might be distinguishable?
Okay, that's right. I would love to know more about the experimental role of measuring Z, but let's not talk about it now because this question's come up many times and never gets answered. Exactly, that's right.
When we start from very quickly, but they only depend on the dimension and about on Z. Basically, they depend only on that, we can risk everything with that. So
that's right. Z will determine.
So
determined.
How can
yes.
I compare your Z with the Z's of the?
Okay, no, this is good. So some of the, in fact, I think what we'll see, okay, what you could imagine using this for is exactly to see which observables only depend on Z and which ones don't. So we have a new class of theories with some Z's. We could put Z equals 2 or 3, you know, the values that you might like, and see whether you get similar results or not. And then you'll learn whether it really only depended on Z or whether there was some sequence and other things. I think it's very natural to try to compare this with results from the kind of theories that we've worked on. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But actually, the point for this particular level, actually, okay, I'll preempt this statement. It turns out that this thing here always goes like omega squared, in fact. So in all. I'm going to talk a little bit about that for the next 5 minutes shortly. But this, it turns out this power law here is actually turns out to be independent of Z, including when Z is infinite or 1 or whatever. Okay, but this general form, so what's happening? So remember there's a delta function sitting here. And right, this delta function was proportional to rho. The charge density. Now imagine heating the system up a lot, okay, so that the temperature is much bigger than the whatever. Right? The temperature is much bigger than the charge density. And then what you're basically doing is you're sort of shifting everything to the UV, to high energy scales, when you're going to recover conformal invariance. So at high temperatures, the conductivity is just going to look like that. It's just going to be a straight line, okay? And this delta function here is going to be more or less negligible because the temperature effects will be dominating over this one. Then as you cool it down, what happens is the delta function starts appearing here. But there's a sum rule that tells you the integral of the conductivity has to be the same. And so you necessarily get a dip there when the delta function appears. Okay. So conformal invariance of the UV plus basic principles of physics and the delta function more or less guarantee this kind of form. I mean, whether you get bumps or not is some extra stuff. But the fact that it looks like this is not surprising. Okay. What I think is interesting is that in many systems you get the same answer here. Now let me come back to why this looks like graphene, but not like a superconductor, because that's just true. So these are. These are measurements. I'm sorry, I'm being extremely bad with references throughout this talk. I apologize to those who are present or absent. But this, okay, some people, I think, in downstates, in San Diego, did this measurement. So these are different, what's this called again? Bias voltages for graphene. And graphene is also a CFT at high energies, okay, right? So it goes to constant, and you have this dip. And now, of course, because it's a real material and not a model, instead of a delta function, you have a Euler peak that gets blown out. Now, here is at least one picture of the optical conductivity in high temperature in disco, I think. And it's a logarithmic plot, but it's basically, it's going like this. And what these people were interested in is that this thing here seemed to have a scaling right, omega to the minus 2/3. Okay, but we don't see anything. There's an interesting structure going the other way. Okay, I just told you there's some robustness going this way, but there's just nothing going that way because we just have a delta function. Okay. Right. So how do we think about? So let me see how we might think about that. So again, I think there is an interesting. And how the word universal has been extremely used in the last 8 years in various quarters, but there's it often comes out that sigma goes like omega squared at low energies, and that seems to be independent of Z. Now, what we're missing that is presumably related to this kind of physics is let's call it a generalized Drude peak. I say generalized because the Drude peak would just be, one of the omega plus one. Okay, so you'd have one of the omegas of the sum regime. And the fact that you maybe get a different scaling here may suggest that something more interesting is going on. But by Drude peak, I just mean something in the conductivity that's going the other way, maybe the origin.
That's the in the holographic calculation that the delta function, the support of that is all at zero, right?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So that's what I mean is missing.
Okay.
It's there. I mean, obviously it's there, but the any physics is associated with how it's borne out is missing.
Okay.
That's yes.
Is omega squared also found in Fermi liquids actually? Weak coupling.
Is that true?
So that was a question, actually.
It's mass. Yeah. No. I do not remember the mass knows. Maybe other people do. but I've talked about it with Max, and I'm afraid I. Do you remember?
No, I don't
remember.
The thermodynamics is totally different than Fermi liquids. So.
Yes. I think it depends on having some scaling symmetry, which here is a bit different from the Fermi liquid scaling symmetry.
Yeah, I don't know. In Fermi liquid, you also have to distinguish it from the Drude peak, which is going to get broadened by something or other.
But suppose there are no lattice, no umlaut, and presumably there is a delta function, and it's not broadened in Fermi liquid.
If the delta function has all the non-analyticities, I mean, sigma has to be an even function, so omega squared is
a good bet.
Natural bet.
No. Okay, that's right. But this, I don't know whether this is something analytic or it's something non-analytic that happens to be. I mean, it's in the imaginary part of the Green's function. Yeah. It could be a mole, right?
I agree. If I didn't know anything, I would have said omega squared, but that doesn't mean it's right.
Is there any way to tease it out using scaling?
In measurements?
No, I just mean mathematically. I mean, you're in a critical theory, so.
No, it's proven. This is true. True. Yes. And indeed,
but
you can tease it out.
Just on the basis of scaling
values. You know.
And see that there are terms.
So, good. This omega squared is a statement about the effective scaling dimension of the current operator in the infrared theory. And you can reverse engineer that to work out what the scaling dimension of the current operator is. The calculations that get that, you get it has some quite messy intermediate steps and then it simplifies. So I'm not sure of a first principles. But you can, it is something you can actually think of. Anyway, so Eva is going to talk, I think, probably tomorrow a little about at least one way of putting in some Drude peak-like physics. It won't make everybody happy, but it's one way to start getting some structure going the other way, at least. Let me explain this statement. So. This is a bit of a fluffy statement, but what I mean is, so I just have this argument, so the spectral weights. So what happens here and here are pretty, morally pretty different things. I mean, they're just different contributions to the spectral weights. I was for a long time under the confusion that they should be closely related because the DC conductivity is only goes to zero limit of the optical conductivity, but this limit is really not the same as sort of trap limit, shall we say, because there's a bunch of stuff just sitting there at zero frequency that might get smeared out. And so the physics of something going like that and thing going like that, I think, are pretty distinct things. And at the moment, maybe a lot of the assumptions say about this guy, I don't know if that's ever accessible in any of these heavy, these strange metals. And people are thinking, have been thinking about how to make sense of that kind of guy as well, as we will talk about tomorrow. I think, and many other things. Okay.
This omega to the minus two thirds behavior that you showed in the optical thing, what regime is that? You're saying we should think of this as like the lowest frequency behavior? I thought it was actually quite a bit higher.
I should know. I don't know. You mean how it compares to like directional bolts? Okay.
I think that you had it on the curve, but I think it was.
What the scale for this?
That's probably wave numbers.
Yes, it was wave numbers. So how do I map that into scale?
1,000 is a wave number is a degree.
Oh, okay.
So it's tiny compared to the air.
Okay, so these low scales. These pots are also at a reasonably high temperatures. I don't know. Is there any? I mean, it seems it'd be great to me if we could, you know, suppress conductivity and have people calculate the optical conductivity, or measure the optical conductivity when you're with in a magnetic field with the conductivity suppressed.
Not with these high, you mean in the Cooper rates? Yeah, not with the high enough magnetic fields to suppress. They measure up to 8 tesla, and the superconductivity gets suppressed at 20 or 30
Perfect. Okay, I want to say a few more things, what I was trying to say here is that there are two questions. I was just trying to distinguish, because I think I only realized this myself somewhat recently, but there are really two questions about transport, the IR transport, okay, there's some of that question, and then they're, I think, physically not the same. And of course, the DC, the temperature-dependent conductivity, is about the maximum of this made-out guy, which is maybe even harder. Okay, so right. And so in principle, they're both accessible using holography, and I talked about how this one is, but I don't think I have experiment. I mean, I don't. It'd be great if there were some experiments in strange metals to compare this to, but I'm not aware of them. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. Do they exist?
Well, maybe. I mean, if you go into the superconducting state. So then all your Drude stuff presumably gets condensed into the delta function. Mm-hmm. And what's left over, maybe, is this.
Right.
And there tends to be a lot of stuff left over in these strongly correlated systems, whereas in simple metals there wouldn't be.
Well, that's excellent too, because that's exactly going to be my next. I mean, I'd like to separate. I would have liked to measure it without going. I'd like to do two things, with the order and without the order. And at the moment, I meant without the order, but indeed, long in two times after that. It'd be great if we could measure these things. You know, what seems to get more attention would be the DC conductivity, and that's harder, but I think holography is working towards it. So, let me see what I want to do. I'm going to go very, very quickly over this slide, because I think John may talk about somewhat related things, but this is related to Xiaoling's question. So Horizon is doing a lot of work for you. Where did they come from? And of course, we don't really understand where horizons and gravity are coming from. There are lots of information paradoxes and so on associated with that. But somehow, somewhat loosely, pictorially speaking, because we have so many degrees of freedom in these large N theories, you have these big N by N matrices, but they're not all equal, okay? The diagonal, roughly, the eigenvalues of the matrices are quite different from the off-diagonal models of the matrices, and one way you might see that is that, please excuse me, people who know more about this, but they're like commutative square interactions, for example, in the theory, and suppose the eigenvalue of these matrices has some expectation value, then this commutator square becomes a mass term for the off-diagonal modes, but not for the diagonal modes. Okay. And that's one way, and then imagine taking this coupling to be large, and which is what we're doing. And so what you might imagine is that you're really decoupling, you're making some subset of the modes much heavier than some other set of modes. And actually better than the language of mass, thinking of scaling dimension in the field theory, that there's like n squared degrees of freedom to have a very large scaling dimension under our UV scaling. And then there are a few modes down here which have order one scaling dimension. Okay. And now it's these modes down here that have the classical gravitational description. And gravity and these become the string states, if you like. Okay? So again, if we know one thing about string theory is that every particle, you get all these excited states as well. Okay, so what are all these other excited states? Where are they? Well, they're all behind the black hole. Okay, roughly, you know, morally speaking, and that's just, these n squared modes are like the excited states of string theory, and gravity can't tell the difference between them. All these, there are many of these orthogonal modes, and that's what the horizon is. Okay, so the horizon is. Right. The reason horizons exist is because of this hierarchy of possible because of this hierarchy and dimension. I hope nobody disagrees with that too strongly, but I think it's more or less true. So in particular, when we calculate this dissipation, what you're doing with these two-point functions, you can think of it as the dissipation from these nodes into moving energy into all these other string states. I want to cover some other things, so I leave it in John's able hands on Wednesday. We'll tell you all about horizons. Okay, so in particular, so this critical sector, so this Lifshitz sector, this Lifshitz metric that I wrote down does have a horizon, okay? Because remember this was dt squared, okay? When r goes to infinity, which is the far infrared, gtt goes to zero. Okay, the time slows down infinitely. Okay, that's what a horizon is. So, this critical sector is manifested in the bulk and event horizon. And now the charge could be either. Remember, we have this charge density, so we have this electric flux. The charge could be either behind the horizon, and it would just be manifested as flux coming from nowhere, or the charge could be outside the horizon. Okay. Like a star or something just sitting there. And this roughly corresponds to whether the string that whether the dynamics of the charge carrying fields is either in these stringy modes or whether they're in these or somehow the dynamics is dominated by these lighter fields. So in this case it's lighter fields or here the charge is carried by these sort of stringier states. So in particular, when the charge is outside of the horizon, from a field theory point of view, it can essentially be thought of in terms of more or less conventional phases of matter that might be coupled to so all these things. There's some, so here, let's say these are fermions. Okay. So these fermions have excitations, and these excitations are more or less Fermi-liquid-like, although that they can still dissipate. So it's this, right? So these charge, when you have the charge outside the horizon, these are really just Fermi liquid fermions living in a complicated box, okay? And all these charge degrees of freedom, so for example, if you calculate the current, the fermions, you can calculate the two-point function of these fermions because you can see them, and you'll get poles that will look like fermi-liquid poles. Okay. Now, what can happen is because we still have this critical sector here, is that these things can get big imaginary flux. as I'm sure John will also talk about on Wednesday, due to the fact that they can fall into this critical, you still have the dissipation into the critical sector, but you can model it semi, or perhaps just non-holographically, as a system of explicit fermions coupled to a critical system. Okay, so let me say that again. When this thing happens, you can throw away holography and think about the system as some fermions, just explicit fermionic operators like you're used to, and then you just couple them to some critical theory that corresponds to them falling into the horizon. But in this case, you can't do that. You're really stuck. You don't see the charge carriers. So again, there are these two different phases that you mentioned. These ones look more conventional, although they can definitely have some interesting features. And these are somehow fractionalized phases where the charge carriers are not naively not gauge invariants, and you have to work harder to think about what you mean. This is also what the sort of distinction Sabir was making about those two. Okay, then we have to jump this statement. Right. So I think the charge when the charge is coming from behind the horizon, they're still pretty mysterious from a field theory point of view. Presumably they're fractionalized phases, okay? In the sense that the gauge fields, the gauge charge of the charge carriers is playing an important role. And now remember that fractionalized is not surprising here, okay? Because we started with gauge fields and we started with quarks that had charge under those gauge fields. So fractionalized phases is what you get at zeroth order. And in fact, you have to work to get a non-fractionalized phase. So you have to confine the quarks. It's right. And so when the quarks confine, that's when it looks like this. And it's more Fermi liquid-like. If the quarks don't confine, then it looks like that. Remember, I say the quarks confine, so the charge sector confines, but there's still a critical bosonic sector in all cases. It's not, the theory is not gapped, it's just that the charge sector has this confined. So I think we really don't understand this. And for example, to date, nobody has demonstrated any non-analytic structure in momentum space, which for these or anything like quantum oscillations for these cases, for the charge that's behind the fractionalized charge. There's also no obvious connection to the way people normally describe, say, gauge fields coupled to Fermi surfaces by these patches. You know, zoom in on the patch and write down the field theories on patches. There's no obvious patch-like structure emerging here. And to understand it, it may well be necessary to consider string effects in the bulk. I'm going to spend only 2 minutes on this. So now, remember the starting point was these phase diagrams. Okay, and we wanted to understand we're sort of coming down here. And so we've got our bad metal in the sense that we have a theory that has some charge carriers and also some other stuff that it can scatter off. And I told you a little bit about how to characterize that. But now we'd also like to understand why there's this sort of genericity of having an ordered phase at the lowest temperatures. So I'm just going to quickly say that there is a very natural way this happens in holography, and I want to say one thing about some features that you get. Now these instabilities, these superconducting and other instabilities that you get, they're all about a balance between gravity, which anti-screens, and some other force that screens. Okay, so by that I mean electromagnetism. If I have some electric field, I have positive charge, negative charge here, and then I have some charged matter, the positive charges go there, the negative charges go there, and it wants to cancel out the effect of the field that you applied. But for gravity, there's only mass. Okay, so all the mass is here, and if I put something here, it clumps. Okay, so it does the opposite of the screen. So now I imagine I have these backgrounds that have an electric field, but also a black hole, and I put a charged particle, a pair of charged, a positive and negatively charged particles there. Right? So electrostatically, they want to go in opposite directions, because one of them wants to get pushed away from the black hole, the other one wants to get attracted. But gravitationally, they both want to fall back into the black hole. Okay? So depending which one wins, the black hole is either stable or it's not. When the screening effect wins, then you're going to pair produce positively charged quanta in the bulk. They're going to get repelled from the black hole, and you land up with a condensate of some charged field sitting outside. Okay. That now breaks the symmetry. It's a very sort of geometric and I think pretty physical natural instability that can happen. So I'm just going to finish with two comments. about what you can do with that. You know what? I'm even going to. Okay, no, I'll say these two comments. So one that with a view towards experiments or connecting with other things. In fact, something that Steve said a few minutes ago. That's the second one. The first one, I just want to maybe repeat the message of Jan's talk because I'm not sure how clearly he got across. So his main point was the following. That because there's a very good point, a very simple one, which I think is interesting, and it's just that the operator that condenses in this framework is some operator, in particular, suppose that TC is much less than the chemical potential, so that all your physics, so the condensation process is entirely in this IR critical regime. The operator that condenses is going to have some scaling dimension under this emergent symmetry. Okay, typically it's going to have some anomalous scaling dimension. It's not going to be the scaling dimension of two bare fermions put together like it would be in BCS theory. In principle, what the Leiding group are suggesting is that you could measure this. You could try to measure the scaling dimension of the Cooper pair operator in the critical theory, if it's there. And you do that, you can read that off from measuring the pairing susceptibility, which is a two-point function. If you could do that, you get a scaling dimension, and if it's not two, or whatever it's meant to be for BCS, then you know that it's not BCS, right? Okay. And that would give you a very direct insight into the strongly coupled dynamics that happens here. Okay, that's one thing.
So you could do the same for particle hole instabilities, like magnetic instabilities.
That's right, yes. Yes, why not? Yes, right. Now, and then one more thing that relates to your previous comment is that at low, now let's go take the system and cool it down so that you have a picture of it like this one, and you go to low temperatures. So what often happens is that these critical modes don't totally gap out, in fact. So for example, the entropy density so what that means is that the metric. So what would gap out mean? So remember, we started with this critical metric that had some scaling here, and now I condense some a boson. So what would the BCS-like picture would be that the space would cap off and gap, and you'd have your boson splitting there. Okay. But actually, what happens, again, I don't know if it's universal, but in many examples, is that this thing still continues with a different z, some z prime, which may be bigger or smaller, I don't know. But some, which tells you that some critical modes survive the gapping. And so you get some entropy that's, again, not exponentially small, but has some scaling. And I think this resonates a little bit with things that Andy is going to talk about tomorrow in some experiments. But it's not obvious that there's any microscopic connection between everything that's happening. But it looks similar, okay, to something you're going to see tomorrow. Okay, and another thing that's morally quite related now, if we go to zero temperature, so this is the critical, this is more about the bosons, these gapless bosons that you had. You didn't manage to get rid of all of them when you condensed your scalar. And also the charge sector, so which you might measure by the conductivity, doesn't, right, so the BCS part is something like that, it's a gap in frequencies. And here, actually, we didn't notice this in the first paper because numerically it looked like it was doing that. But actually, there is a small power law tail. even in S-wave superconductors. So you can do T-wave things, and then you would expect this, but even in the S-wave superconductors, you get something like that. Okay, so I don't want to take up any more of your time. There's lots of talks coming this week. So let me just summarize. So holographic systems, you start with a large number of critical modes. Okay, you put them in. You add some charge to get something you hope will be a critical metal. I think pretty generic features that have been understood at this point is that you get a Landau dumping in the sense that charge back reacts on the scaling of the critical sector, and that by dissipating into the critical sector, you seem to get some kind of nice curve here for the optical conductivity. I think things that we need to understand better are what they're called the generalized unity, which is that thing there, and also how to think about fractionalized phases and whether there's the 2KM singularities or some kind of structure in momentum space. There are natural instabilities that involve overcoming the gravitational anti-screening, okay? And criticality seems to, some of the criticality seems to survive the onset of ordering, which may be related to things that Andy will talk about tomorrow. Thanks.
So I guess topological phases are about even further away from where the star is, right? The gap phases.
It's not, people in this room, you're welcome to disagree with me, but it's not obvious that you're likely to learn anything.
I disagree.
I know
there's one good example of the case where we learn something holographically about gap phases, which is people have constructed holographic fractional topological insulators, which is like otherwise we only know from slate particle constructions. And having there you're using the.
Do you want to stop the gauge theory?
But it's a time reversal invariant state with fractional theta over pi. Just as a proof of principle that such a thing exists.
And now there's an electric circle model by.
Oh, that's nice.
By few people, Michael Levin and stuff.
Good. That's almost as artificial.
But it doesn't mean any shape on.
But I think the point is that you may be able to describe these fractional topology in their model which has strongly interacting with the
Right, yeah, sure. But I don't know if it's not a useful model of anyone that you could actually make, but just as a proof of principle that such a state exists, I think it's valuable.
And tells you whether there is a decent fine state.
Yeah, that's right. That's an example.
My theory is that you'll get out what you put in, but
I mean. No, you're really using the strongly coupled gauge theory. The fact that it.
Okay.
It's a couple of things for me.
Okay, yeah. Right. So the fact that you're saying the fact that n equals 4 and so on exists, give you as theories. Give you ways of constructing topological phases, I guess. That's something that's
interesting.
But this holography, what's holography?
It's solving the strongly coupled gauge theory for it.
Okay.
Yes.
I can get what you would hope for, it's not trivial.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
You're an author of this paper, yes.
So we're going to hear about this in the later part of Joseph, basically. He's talking about the fractional topology.
Okay, thanks. It is somewhat orthogonal to what I'm thinking of here, but yeah. Okay, so check the schedule, there are a lot of talks this week, and see you there. Thank you.